KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Earth faces countless global challenges today. Overpopulation, climate change, natural resource depletion, to name a few. Ramez Nam argues that the only solution is innovation. Nam is a computer scientist who spent a decade at Microsoft, where he helped develop early versions of Outlook and Internet Explorer. Nam's latest book is called The Infinite Resource, The Power of Ideas on a Finite Planet. He spoke at Town Hall on September 9th, 2013.
Thank you for that very warm welcome, that very warm introduction. It's great to be here at Town Hall, where I've enjoyed so many talks. It's wonderful to see so many faces I know and so many I don't know. Thank you all for coming out on a beautiful, beautiful evening. I wouldn't be indoors tonight, so I appreciate that you're here. So what I'm going to talk about is this question. Can innovation save the planet? It's a very vitally important question. And it's based on my book, The Infinite Resource, The Power of Ideas on a Finite Planet. So there's a contradiction in terms there. Are ideas an infinite resource while the planet itself is clearly finite? I want to couch this in the framework of Charles Dickens, actually, who 150 years ago started his book, A Tale of Two Cities, with this sentence: it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And that, in many ways, encapsulates the situation that we're living in today. It certainly encapsulates the dialogue that we have. I spent a lot of my time in Silicon Valley, I talked to audiences there, and the dominant feeling down there is it's the best of times, techno-optimism. But certainly if you look at the state of the environment, our view is that it is the worst of times in many ways. So in some ways, both of these are true. If you look at numbers about the state of humanity, it is actually very hard to dispute the idea that it is the best of times. Humanity is, in fact, in the best state it's ever been at. And let me illustrate that with where I have come from. I was born in a working-class neighborhood in Cairo, Egypt, in 1973 that looks a lot like this. I had a 1 in 6 chance of not making it to my 5th birthday, because that's how high infant mortality was in Cairo when I was born. And that number wasn't even that remarkable, because in my parents' generation, it was much worse. 3 of my dad's siblings died in their infancy before reaching their 5th birthday. 5 of my mom's siblings died before reaching their 5th birthday. In fact, it was so common, kids dying in their infancy, that my dad wasn't even the first kid in his family to bear his name. They just recycled the name from a previous kid who was born and died. That was just par for the course. It's just what you did. So growing up, I came to the U.S. at age 3, so I got all these horror stories, and as a kid, I didn't care. I was like, Mom and Dad, yeah, whatever, shut up. The old country was bad, I understand. America rocks. Okay. But over time, I learned that I wasn't just getting a view of another country, I was getting a view back in time. Because when you look back in time at the United States, it was actually a lot like this. In 1900, infant mortality in the U.S. was the same as it was in Egypt in 1940, 25%. In Chicago, in 1900, it was 33%. 1 in 3 children born in Chicago in 1900 would die before their 5th birthday. That's just how the world was a little over a century ago. And the change is stunning. Now in Egypt, even in the midst of turmoil, it's down to 2%. And in the U.S., it's about 2/3 of 1%. In Europe, it's about 1/2 of 1%. So that number summarizes a huge amount of progress that humanity has made. We can see that reflected in how long people live. If you look at life expectancy, which is probably the best metric overall of well-being, it correlates with education, with freedom from violence, with getting enough to eat, with having a roof over your head. That number has soared in the world overall, and especially in the rich nations, but even more so in the world overall in the last century. In fact, in 1900, life expectancy around the world was just over 30 years. Now it's 67 years. And the gap between the rich world and the poor world has been cut in half in about that time. Okay. Poverty. The Economist ran a cover about a month ago saying the end of poverty is possible within the next generation, the end of extreme poverty around the world. Not what we call poverty, but true destitute poverty around the world. And when we look at the numbers, the fraction of people around the world who live on a dollar a day adjusted for inflation has plummeted from more than a third of humanity in 1970 down to less than 10% of humanity now. Now there's still a huge number that live on less than $2 a day, which is still far too little money. But on all of those metrics, it's going down, down, down. And in a number of ways, we can see that humanity is just getting better and better and better. Who can name this city? Shanghai, very good. They will get harder. I chose Shanghai for a reason. Shanghai, 20 or 30 years ago, was little more than a fishing village by a bend in the river. And its rise reflects the incredible rise in well-being of more than a billion people in China who now have access to mobile phones and travel and the internet and consumer goods and automobiles in some cases and larger homes. And that's happening not just in China, but in India, in Southeast Asia, in Latin America. Around the world, humanity is actually entering the 21st century. In some cases, portions of humanity are entering the 20th century for the first time. So when you look at the well-being of humanity, we are truly at the highest well-being we've ever seen. But we are also facing the greatest potential risks we've ever seen to the planet that all of that well-being depends upon. Let's start with the planet's lungs. That's what The Economist magazine called the world's forests. In prehistory, about half of the world's land area was forested. Today, it's one quarter. We've chopped down half of the world's original forests. We've done that almost entirely to grow food, to grow crops or to graze. And that has consequences, because those forests are vital for recycling water. They are vital for sequestering carbon. They're vital because they hold about three-quarters of the on-land biodiversity, of the on-land species that we know of. So that is something that we depend upon, and half of it is gone. Water. Water is life. We depend upon water. Without water, there is no way for civilization to survive. We use 70% of the fresh water that humanity uses goes to this, to growing food. It's not the shower you take. It's not the washing of your dishes, it's the food that humanity eats. That's overwhelmingly what the fresh water we use is for. And there is a lot of water on this planet, but there are problems. Who can name this body of water? The RLC, very good. The RLC is the fourth largest body of fresh water on the planet. Sorry, it was the fourth largest body of fresh water on the planet. It was approximately the size of the Great Lakes combined, but now it's essentially gone. It's gone because it nestles between Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, and in the last days of the USSR, the Soviet Union started pumping the rivers that flow into the RLC and then started pumping the RLC itself out in order to grow wheat in Ukraine. And then even after the RLC, after the USSR fell, the successor states kept on this policy of using all of this fresh water flowing into it and using the fresh water that remained to grow wheat and cotton in that area. And so now this area, the perimeter of it, is dotted with essentially the bones of fishing villages. If you zoom in on some of these maps, you can see old villages that are deserted. You can see beached boats lying where there is no water. Now, as I said, the RLC is between Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, so most Americans would be hard-pressed to find it on a map. So it's a very distant prospect for most of us, but there are some problems closer to home. Who can name this body of water? Ogallala Aquifer, very good. This is subterranean water. There is no giant freshwater sea in the middle of the Great Plains, except that there is one underwater, or underground. The Ogallala Aquifer is what we call fossil water. You've all heard the term fossil fuels, right? Fuels that have been left there for millennia, or millions of years. This is not quite that old. That's pretty old. It was left there at the end of the last ice age, between 10 and 12,000 years ago, when the glaciers melted. And the melt of that water has remained there ever since. Well, we've pumped out about a quarter of this water. And at current pace, by mid-century, we will have pumped out about half of this water. And right now, there are places in the middle of the aquifer where the water table is dropping at 3 feet per year. There are places in North Texas where the wells are simply going dry and where farming is simply ending because those communities can no longer extract water from that area. And the refill rate from normal rainfall of this aquifer is also on the order of about 10,000 years. So for the time frame of human civilization, once it's gone, it's gone. Now somebody tweeted at me after I tweeted about this talk, it's not the planet we have to worry about, it's the people. And to a certain extent, that's true. This aquifer, in 10,000 years, will be full again. Right? The aquifer will still be there. But humanity actually depends upon this aquifer to grow food in this large area of the U.S. heartland. And so we depend upon these services that nature provides for us. And we are using up this essentially one-time resource. Now, even though I've brought up this U.S.-centric issue, the real issue with water is not focused in the U.S. The real area of problem, this is a map that shows where the biggest areas of water threat, water scarcity are, is here. This nexus, this intersection, is the area where three nuclear-armed states, India, Pakistan, and China, all meet in the Himalayas, and where 1.5 billion people all get their food from meltwater of the Himalayas, and where those states have great water stress, and where they've exchanged barbs and diplomatic threats over access to the rivers that flow through this region. So there is a nexus of water, food, and security that comes with the increasing demands upon this scarce resource. There's plenty of fish in the sea, we've all heard that saying. Once upon a time, I've heard it more than once, actually. It's been true. It's less true than it used to be, sadly, when we talk about literal fish. Essentially, every fish species that humanity eats is either at the maximum amount that it can be exploited, about a third of them, or the other two-thirds that humanity eats are beyond that. What I mean by beyond that is we have already exploited them faster than their populations can rebound and are continuing to, essentially because no law protects them. So fishermen can just keep going out. We see this also in the fact that it takes more tonnage of boats going further distances per ton of fish retrieved. It's much harder to catch fish than it was 50 years ago because they're less scarce and less dense in the sea than they once were. And then there's a threat that exacerbates every other threat out there, which is climate change. The planet has a fever. This is what's happened with temperature over the last 130 years or so. It's gone up and up and up. Now you'll notice it's a noisy graph. This temperature line isn't smooth. It's not that every year is warmer than the last year. It bounces around because nature is like that. It's a messy system. Up and down, up and down, up and down. But over the long run, it goes up. And over that 130 years, it's about 2 degrees Fahrenheit that the planet has warmed. Okay? Now, how many of you have heard that climate change has ended, that it's stopped? Some of you have heard this. This is what we call the climate escalator. And what it shows, these blue lines are how you can show at any point that you choose to, you can show that climate change has stopped. Oh, look, the planet cooled, the planet cooled, the planet cooled, it cooled again, it stopped, it cooled again a little bit. But somehow, when you put that all together, the planet kept on warming. So the next time somebody tells you the planet has stopped warming, I'll tell you where to find this graph. This is actually at a place called skepticalscience.com, which has amazing information about climate change in a very, very easy to consume and very science-based way. So the planet does keep on warming, even if there are a few years where things oscillate back and forth. Now, for some people, graphs and math are the way that their minds work. That's how my mind works. But for others, a picture is worth 1,000 words or 1,000 graphs in some cases. So let me show you some pictures. This is the Bear Glacier in Alaska. Sorry, it's kind of down low. This is what it looked like in 1920. This is what it looks like today, or 2005. Basically gone. This is the Peterson Glacier in Alaska in 1920. This is the Peterson Glacier in Alaska today. It's just stunning. It's just gone. Same time of year, it is just gone. Now, climate change is felt most severely at the poles. That's where we'll feel it first and most severely. A 2-degree change in temperature averaged on the planet means something like a 6 or 8 degree change at the poles. So that's why you are seeing such a massive change right there. Now, when you think of climate change, what's the impact that you think of most on the planet? How's it going to affect us? Sea levels. Somebody said drought. Very good. Sea levels is what most people say. And you're right. We are going to see, most likely this century, sea levels rise 3 to 6 feet. But when you think about that, that's a ways out. A century, 3 to 6 feet. Doesn't sound necessarily so bad. It is actually pretty bad. But somebody said drought, and I want to come back to that, because there is real impact being felt right here and now. Okay? 2003. Europe was hit by its worst heat wave and worst drought recorded since 1540. Actually, recorded ever, just the records only go back to 1540. 70,000 people died of the heat and the drought. Ukraine lost 3/4 of its wheat crop. Portugal saw 1/10 of its forests burn down in that one summer. China, 2009, a once-in-a-century level drought. That happens. China, 2010, another once-in-a-century level drought. My statistics are not that strong, but I think something was wrong there. Now, when the rains came back, they came back later that year on Pakistan, where an area the size of Germany, twice the size of California, was inundated, was completely underwater. 15 million people had to be evacuated. The connection between these two events is that warmer air can carry more moisture. It has more moisture demand. Every degree Celsius means it can carry about 8% more water. But it's not homogeneous. It doesn't just get more humid. Instead, what happens is that warmer air can suck up more water from one place in time and then deposit it in a deluge rapidly in another place in time. So we see over the last few decades that drought has increased in frequency and that the most extreme rainfalls have also increased in frequency, which is bad news if you want to grow food, because both conditions are pretty adverse for the ability of humans to have agriculture. Russia, 2010, 55,000 people died of a heat wave between July and August. In Moscow, in those 2 months alone, 11,000 people died. And the U.S. has not been immune. We've been suffering through 2 years, almost 3 years, of severe drought and heat. And this year, San Francisco was threatened by the Rim Fire that has threatened its water supplies, electrical supplies. We just had a paper come out that did the analysis and said extreme heat waves in the U.S. are already, because of climate change, 4 times more likely than they once were. We see that the incidence of wildfires in the U.S., or the acreage that they burn, is up about 4 times more than it was in the 1950s and 1960s because of climate change. Flood surges the size of Sandy's are twice as common already because of climate change. These are not hypothetical future risks. No, there's worse hypothetical future risks. This is what's happening already. We are already feeling the impact. That's what I want to hammer home here. Okay? Now, all of that, all of what we're feeling already, is just what happens to the first half of this graph. That's the temperature that we're experiencing right now. Just what happens through here on this little bit there, 1 degree Celsius, 2 degrees Fahrenheit, that's what has caused the impact so far. The right hand of this graph are the projections of temperature change for the rest of the century. The blue projections are if we take strong action right now. So we've already locked in a fair bit of additional warming in the best case. The red lines, and you can see there's big uncertainty, are if we kind of continue par for the course. So we've had this much, 1 degree of impact, and we're gearing up for potentially 5 or 6 degrees Celsius, 10 or 12 degrees Fahrenheit of impact. So this is the 100-year context. That's a century, and then another century to come. Here's the 10,000-year context. Okay, this is the last 10,000 years. You can stand up if you can't see this. Sorry that this is kind of low for you guys. 10,000 years ago, agriculture was invented here. This line is temperature. Okay? temperature went like this. The transistor was invented about here. We went to the moon around here. This is now. This is how hot it's gotten. The red line is projections for the rest of the century. Now, there's lots of error bars and climate projections, so it could be that actually it only ends up here, or it could be that it ends up here. Either way, the size of the red line means that we're entering a temperature domain that humanity has never seen during civilization. Writing was invented about here. That's what's coming. So this is a threat to take seriously.
Ramez Nam, a computer scientist and the author of The Infinite Resource, The Power of Ideas on a Finite Planet. He spoke at Town Hall on September 9th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Ramez Nam in a moment. 927, 94.9 KUOW. Iran's new president Hassan Rouhani addressed the United Nations General Assembly on Tuesday. Although he and President Obama didn't shake hands, the two leaders expressed their desire to open a dialogue. Iran wants harsh economic sanctions lifted to help restore its economy. The United States and other Western nations want to contain Iran's nuclear program and to augment nuclear weapons inspections in the country, in Iran, that is. Former CIA analyst Kenneth Pollack, now a Middle East specialist at the Brookings Institution, calls President Rouhani the real deal and urges Western leaders to take his overtures seriously. Hear Kenneth Pollack talk about it tomorrow in the noon hour. Lows around 50 tonight, says the forecast for the Seattle area. Mostly clear this evening, then becoming mostly cloudy. Friday highs around 60. Rain at times. Support for KUOW comes from the Strangers Genius Awards, providing cash grants to local artists every September in Seattle. More about the 2013 finalists in literature, art, performance, music, and film, and the awards show on September 28th at thestranger.com/genius.
Hi, this is Rachel Martin of NPR News. As an informed listener, you know that your membership matters. When you join others who contribute financial support, you help ensure KUOW and NPR will be here for you every day. You may have recently received an appeal in the mail. Please mail in your gift today or give online at kuow.org. Your support right now will help keep the upcoming pledge drive on target. Thanks.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Can innovation save our planet? That's the question computer scientist Ramez Nam asked earlier this month at Town Hall. Nam is the author of The Infinite Resource, The Power of Ideas on a Finite Planet. He argues that innovation is the only solution to the challenges facing Earth. Next, he continues to talk about climate change.
Now, you try to add up all of these different impacts on the planet, all these different ways that we're utilizing the planet's resources, and people try to say, can we summarize all of this in one number? And what they use is footprint. How much of the Earth's resources are we using up? And the way that they summarize the footprint is, you know, if we add up all of humanity, what fraction of the Earth? And what the footprint network concludes is we're not using one planet Earth's worth of resources, we're using about 1.5 planet Earth's worth of resources. And I don't have a spare half planet Earth. If any of you do, come see me. I've got a great idea. And a challenge here is that Americans, on average, use 3 or 4 times the resources of people around the world. Right? And so those people in China or in the rest of the world who are rising out of poverty and for good reason want automobiles or larger homes or computers or central air conditioning are going to be using more resources as they rise out of poverty. And so if everyone in the world lived like an American, we wouldn't be using 1 planet Earth or 1.5 planet Earth. We'd be using about 5 planet Earth's worth of resources. And I definitely don't have 4 spare planet Earth's worth of resources, at least not in these trousers. You can only make light sometimes. So this conundrum is probably best summarized in the best-selling environmental book of all time, which is called The Limits to Growth, which looked at all of this and basically said, hey, look, if you keep consuming resources, ultimately you go beyond the carrying capacity of the planet, you tip over a cliff, and your civilization collapses. And that's basically what this line simulates, is hey, your society goes like this, 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 you're damaging your ecosystem like this, and eventually your society falls off a cliff too, because you've just damaged, you've degraded your planet too far. Okay, I'm an optimist. So you can't be a Pollyanna. You can't say everything's just going to be okay, but you can look at the problems and say, maybe there's something we can do about it. And you have to start by saying, what have we done in the past? And we do have a long history of overcoming limits like this. There's a lot of stories about that. I'm going to tell you just one. What's this? It's a whale. Blue whale? Now, what kind of whale is it? Beluga. Another kind of whale? Sperm whale. Very good. Excellent. This is a Pacific sperm whale. It's eating a squid right now. Actually, it's eating a giant squid, which tells you how big the sperm whale is. The sperm whales almost went extinct on this planet. In a period of about 20 years, we killed off a third of this species, about 250,000 of them. We killed them off not because we ate them, not because we valued their meat, but because sperm whales were an energy source. Sperm whale oil was the premier source of lighting in the world. And so a fleet of about 900 boats in North America and additional boats in Europe hunted these sperm whales all around the world. And in fact, Moby Dick was written about a true event. What happened was that over time, as we were hunting sperm whales to collect their oil to fill these lamps, sperm whales became scarcer and scarcer. The whaling ships had to go farther and farther. The price of whale oil went up and up. We had sort of a peak whale oil event. And the whales that existed became more and more averse to humans. And so a whaling ship called the Essex saw a pod of females, went to try to spear them, and a rogue male that was nearby that had probably survived a couple whaling attacks before saw this happening and got very agitated. And he dove and came up and speared the Essex, and then dove again and came up and speared the Essex again and sank it. And Melville heard about this and wrote Moby Dick. So that was where this was going, except that despite that story, the humans were eventually going to win. We were eventually going to wipe out all of the sperm whales, even though, at the same time, demand was rising faster than supply and the prices were going through the roof. Now, what solved this conundrum was not the extermination of all sperm whales, was not the creation of more sperm whales, it was an innovation. It was an innovation by this man. This is Abraham Gessner. He's a Canadian, or was, a Canadian geologist and physician. So in those days, you could be both. And he invented something called kerosene. Gessner knew that there was a huge demand for a new lighting product that could provide a clear, odorless light that didn't flicker, which was the advantage of sperm whale oil, that the price of lighting had gone up through the roof, and so he set out to try to find one. And he found that if he could heat up coal in a very dry way and capture the vapors, he could make this thing called kerosene. And so he created this. He sold it at a fraction of the price, less than a tenth the price of sperm whale oil. He could make it in thousands of times the quantities that sperm whale oil could ever be gained. And he basically put all those ships out of business and probably saved that species from extinction. Now, Gessner, so far as we know, was not an environmentalist. He doesn't mention the whales at all in his journals. But he probably saved that species from extinction through his innovation. This innovation, by the way, was obsoleted within about 20, 30 years because the electric light was invented and came on the market shortly thereafter, making kerosene lamps fairly obsolete, though you still find a few of them in use. We have overcome limits many, many, many times. 200 years ago, Malthus wrote this book where he predicted that we could not possibly feed the planet. We could not possibly feed England. And he turned out to be wrong, because innovations in agriculture meant that we increased the amount of food we could grow at a far faster rate than he believed was totally possible. Right? Many years later, in 1968, Paul Ehrlich wrote this book, The Population Bomb, that basically repeated Malthus. Ehrlich started this book with the sentence, "The war to feed humanity is over." That was sentence one. Sentence two, "At this late date, nothing can be done to stop a rise in the worldwide death rate." Sentence three, "Billions will die." I mean, that was his prediction. He's still quoted widely as an expert and a prognosticator and a great theorist in this area. And he was wrong. After he wrote this book, the famine rate and the death rate went down. The number of calories available per person on Earth has gone up, and hunger has dropped continuously since that time, because they both ignored two things. One, the true vastness of physical resources on Earth has eluded most people. Okay? Let's talk about that for just a second. This drop of oil represents all the energy that humanity uses from all sources combined, from oil, coal, natural gas, nuclear, hydro, so on. It's actually a very, 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 very large drop of oil, if we think about it that way. But it's actually dwarfed by a much, much larger source of energy, which is the continual influx of energy from our sun. To scale, this is what that looks like. The influx of sunlight that the Earth receives is 10,000 times the energy content of what we use from all energy sources on this planet combined. At the top of the atmosphere, 10 seconds of sunlight has the equivalent energy to one day of humanity's energy use from all sources. 1 hour of sunlight has the same energy content as 1 year of humanity's energy use from all sources combined. There is no shortage, right now at least, of available energy for us to use. That's not the problem. This energy manifests as differential heating of the atmosphere that creates wind. It manifests as evaporation of water that comes down as rain and creates hydropower that we can tap into. And it manifests as direct photons striking the ground that are so abundant that 1/3 of 1% of the land area of the Earth, using current technology, is enough space to capture enough energy to power humanity through 2030. That's how abundant solar energy in all of its myriad forms, and wind and hydro as well, is already. Abundance is not the problem. The same is true of water. We talk about freshwater scarcity, and freshwater is scarce, but water overall is not scarce. We live on a water world. 70% of the surface of this planet is water, and the vast majority of the water on this planet, well over 98%, is salt water that we can't access. In fact, we access, in total, less than 0.1% of the water. The problem is that most of that water is not accessible to us because it's too salty for us to drink or apply to our fields to grow crops. That's the real problem. The same is true of food. Farms convert less than 0.1% of the sunlight that falls onto them into calories in the food that we eat. Looking at how much food we could grow on current farmland, the International Food Policy Research Institute believed that we could take this much grain that we grow, 2.6 billion tons, and turn it into more than 70 billion tons on current land with the available nutrients that are in the soil. The problem is not the sunlight, it's not the land, it's how smart we are. The resources aren't the limits, it's our ability to innovate, to tap into them in a productive way and in a sustainable way, in an ongoing form. So innovations multiply resource access. Okay, let's talk about that. The limiting factor with solar power hasn't been how much sunlight there is, how much land there is, it's been this. This is a wafer of solar panels. If it looks like a wafer of silicon chips for your computer, that's because they've been made in extremely similar ways, and that means they've been very, very expensive. The limiting factor has been how expensive it is to deploy solar power throughout the world. But that has changed over time. In the last 30 years, since 1980, the price of solar power has dropped by a factor of 20. It's dropped by 95%. You can buy 20 times more solar power for a dollar today than you could when Ronald Reagan was president. And what that means is we've gone from a point when solar power was a novelty to, as you saw maybe in Alex's talk of the monk powering his computer via solar so he could blog about how to be a better Buddhist, we've gone to the point that it's actually practical. And we're just reaching now a critical threshold. We're reaching the crossover point in price. We're reaching the point where solar power, even without government subsidies, which it actually deserves, but even without government subsidies, is crossing the price of fossil fuels for electricity. That point is being achieved right now in some places in the world, and it'll be achieved where the majority of people live by the end of the next 10 to 12 years. It'll happen in waves based on how much sunlight there is. It's happening right now in the U.S. Southwest. It's not happening, I'm sorry to say, here in Seattle. The yellow area is not the sunniest in the world. But if you live in the Southwest, it is now to the point where we are seeing solar installations at scale, where solar companies are bidding and winning bids by just pricing their solar panels, their solar power, cheaper than grid electricity wholesale. In Europe, it's happening, and it's happening in an interesting way, because the rich nations in Europe are the northern European nations, but the countries that have the most solar power there are in the south, and indeed North Africa, areas like Turkey, and Eastern Europe are the ones that are well blessed with more solar power. And in fact, it's even more interesting on a global basis, because if you looked at a map of where the world's poor exist, and you looked at a map of where the world has the most solar energy, you'd find that they look remarkably similar. Because the places in the world that are blessed with the most solar energy, the U.S. is actually quite blessed, but there's an awful lot of it in places that have the largest fraction of poverty in the world. So we're going to see a revolution, I think, in the next 10, 15 years, where solar is going to get to the point where it no longer needs to be subsidized to win out against fossil fuels in many of these places. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't continue to give it a market advantage in some ways, and we'll come back to that later.
Ramez Nam, a computer scientist and the author of The Infinite Resource, The Power of Ideas on a Finite Planet. He spoke at Town Hall on September 9th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Ramez Nam in a moment, 944, 94.9 KUOW. Tomorrow evening on LiveWire Radio, Lynn Shelton, writer and director, responsible for films like Hump Day and most recently Touchy Feely. Also Stacy Bolt, essayist and author of Breeding in Captivity. And Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down, a San Francisco-based alternative folk rock music group, all recorded on stage in front of a live audience in Portland, Oregon. Tomorrow evening at 8. Lows around 50 tonight for the Seattle area. Mostly clear this evening, then becoming mostly cloudy. Friday highs around 60. Rain at times. Longtime pop music icon, singer Johnny Mathis talks with Michael Feinstein about what's behind his enduring success, Song Travels, at 10 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from the Natural Resources Defense Council, announcing a new Robert Redford-produced video about tar sand oil that can be viewed at demandcleanpower.org. Support for KUOW comes from Custom Pure, the water store, providing water filters for the kitchen and bath with home and office installation and service since 1981. Located in Shoreline and online at CustomPure.com.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Ramez Nam is a computer scientist and the author of The Infinite Resource, The Power of Ideas on a Finite Planet. He spoke at Town Hall on September 9th, 2013.
Now, of course, we sometimes want to use electricity when the sun isn't shining. The sun might have set out there already, and we have the lights on here. Thank goodness this projector needs to run even if it's dark outside. Our cities need power when the sun isn't shining or when the wind isn't blowing. We also want to be able to use power in our vehicles. We need it in a compact form. It can't be a solar panel the size of your house on top of your car to keep you moving. So for both of those, we need storage. And in many ways, storage now is a harder problem than capturing enough energy by itself. And many people are now saying, oh, storage is the problem, you can't solve storage, and so renewables will never take off, you'll never get them to replace fossil fuels in the grid because you won't solve the storage problem. But in storage, too, we have a long history of an incredible decline in price and increase in density. This red line is what happened with price over a 20-year period. That's a reduction in price of 10x, a 90% price drop over actually about 15 years. And if we do that one more time, we'll essentially have grid storage cheap enough that we can store that power from solar panels and wind power overnight and when the wind isn't blowing to keep our houses running. This yellow line is density. How much storage, how much energy can you store per unit weight? That has about tripled over the last 20 years. It's tripled. Both of these lines actually have moved primarily because of competition among laptop vendors and mobile phone vendors, so that you want a device that's going to last all day and that's cheap. Right? And that competition has driven this number to go up. As that keeps going up, electric cars will increase in range. And, by the way, your laptop and phone will run for longer as well, which is a nice plus. So I conclude that this is viable if we keep innovating at this pace. That's the big if. That's the critical if. Now, that was energy. And there's no coincidence that I started with energy, because energy is, in a sense, the master resource. If we can crack energy, we can crack so many other problems. We live on a water world, as I said, but it's salt water. Well, if you want fresh water and you have salt water, if you apply energy, you can have fresh water. Now, historically, desalination has been considered an incredibly anti-environmental technology. It's incredibly messy. It produces too much carbon emissions. You don't want to do it. But in addition to the possibility that we're going to have enough energy available to do this, something else has happened over the last 40 years. Up until 1970, desalination was done the same way the Greeks did it in 400 BC, which is you boiled water, and then you caught the steam and condensed it. That was actually described in 400 BC. More or less the same thing. Since the 1970s, we've been doing something else, an act of biomimicry. Every cell in your body desalinates. Every cell in your body has a selectively permeable membrane that decides what to let through and what not to. So scientists started mimicking this with plastics in the 1970s. And by doing so, we've reduced the amount of energy that it takes to desalinate water by a factor of about 10 in the last 40 years. Now, in fact, we've dropped this so far that in the modern desalination plants, like those being built in Israel, it costs about 1 cent per 5 gallons of desalinated water. Compare that to the bottled water that you're going to buy perhaps later. Now, to be honest, even that price is not cheap enough yet for bulk water that we use to water our fields, but it's getting there. And again, if we keep innovating on this path, we will get to the point that at least for coastal regions, and there are quite a few deserts near oceans with a lot of sunlight and a lot of salty water, that this will become an actually viable path to solving some of the fresh water access. This same technology, by the way, is also widely usable for purifying and cleaning wastewater, which is another great use in a number of situations. Food. Between now and 2050, we have to increase the amount of food we grow by about 70%. About half of that is to keep up with the population, and about half of that is to keep up with richer diets being eaten around the world. And that's a challenge, but we know that we can do it. Here's why. The yellow line is how much food we grow per acre around the world. The red line is how much we need to grow per acre around the world by 2050 to keep up with demand. The green line is how much we grow in the US and Europe and Canada and Japan per acre already. And the difference between these two is basically energy. The difference is that in industrialized countries, we have tractors, we have irrigation systems, we have fertilizer. So that tells us that already the world's farms could meet the demand that we're going to see by 2050. Though there are perhaps more energy efficient ways that don't mean just using a lot more energy. This is corn. This is wheat. Which of these grows more per acre? Fifty-fifty. It's corn. Half of you got it right, I think. Corn grows about 70% more per acre. Corn does this because it's an innovator itself. It's tapped into a very, very recent innovation. This is so recent, it's only about 30 million years old. On an evolutionary timescale, that's actually very, very new. Corn does something called C4 photosynthesis. What that means is basically corn is more efficient at using sunlight, water, and carbon dioxide to turn into sugars and carbohydrates. It breathes at night is the big difference, whereas wheat breathes during the day. That also means corn uses less water. It's better surviving drought. But ultimately, mostly, it just gives us more calories per acre. So a team at the Gates Foundation, or funded by the Gates Foundation, is asking, what if we could take the couple genes that allow corn to do this and move them into rice, ashes where they're starting, and wheat? Then we could take the two grains that humans eat most on this planet, rice and wheat, and increase their output by 70% as well. And this would be a genetically modified organism, but it wouldn't be done by some agribusiness that would patent it, seeking a monopoly. It would be done to be given away to the world's farmers, whoever they are, in the goal of raising crop yields around the world. What's this on the left? Soy, that was an easy one. Good. All right. Which of these needs more fertilizer, soy or wheat? You know this stuff too well, David. All right. Wheat does. The reason for that is soy is a legume. Soy has symbiotic bacteria that suck nitrogen out of the atmosphere and put it in the soil. Nitrogen is what's in most fertilizer. That's the primary ingredient in fertilizer. Wheat can't do that. But clover, soy, peas, they can do that with the help of these little symbiotic bacteria. Okay? But with wheat and rice and corn and millet and barley and oats and all the things that we mostly consume and feed to our animals, they can't. So we have to apply fertilizer, either animal manure or synthetic fertilizer. And that's especially a problem for people in the developing world that can't afford those inputs. So another grant, actually a pair of grants, funded by the Gates Foundation, is asking what if they could take the genes that make that possible in legumes and move those into rice and wheat and so on. And again, this would be a genetically modified organism. But again, the goal is not some large business monopolizing this crop. The goal is take the farmers around the world that can't afford to buy fertilizer and give them a way to grow these crops with higher yields without having to buy those inputs. And that's a way that could spread much faster than funding more tractors and more fertilizer plants around the world. Now, the last couple innovations that I showed, I was talking about using more energy, but the last few that I showed were actually about using less. These are about reducing resource use, less energy to desalinate, less energy to grow food, because innovations do that too. In fact, over the last 10,000 years, we've tremendously reduced all sorts of things. 10,000 years ago, it took this much land, about 3,000 acres, to feed one person. This is the average, we think, that it took to feed one hunter-gatherer. Today, it takes about one-third of 1 acre to feed one person on Earth, on average. That's what's happened in 10,000 years, a 10,000x reduction in the amount of land per person that's used. Now, some of that you've heard is it is the industrialization of farming, but it's not, oddly enough, more energy being inputted. This is what's happened with energy per calorie grown in the U.S. over the last 40 years. We put in half as much energy per calorie that we grow in the U.S. because we've gotten smarter. We also put in about half as much water per energy per calorie grown in the U.S. because we've gotten smarter. We've gone from flood irrigation to spray irrigation and to drip irrigation. In all these ways, we're getting more and more precise, more and more efficient. Planes. I often fly when I give this talk. And that has its own ecological cost, right? But one thing that most of us don't know is today's fleet of jet airliners use about a third as much fuel per passenger mile as the jet airliners that flew in the 1960s because the engines are better designed. That's even before the Dreamliner that's in this picture right here. Oil. How much do Americans use more oil or less oil than we used to? Less. You know, it's kind of a trick question, or it's easy because you know what I've been talking about here. Americans actually, per person, use about half as much oil as we did in the 1970s, which is a shocking, shocking number in a lot of ways. We even peaked out how much water per person we use. We still use too much, but after rising for 70 years, per person water use in the U.S. peaked in the 1970s and has gone down and down, and when we have the finalized numbers for 2010, they're going to be about here, which means that Americans use about as much water per person as we did in 1950. That we've dropped down to that level. And this isn't just America. The same things are happening in Europe, in Japan, in all of the industrialized countries. We've actually peaked per person consumption and are going back down in a number of ways. And perhaps the most important reduction of all is this one. In 1950, the average woman on Earth would have 5 children over the course of her lifetime. Today, the average woman alive on Earth will have 2.4 children over the course of her lifetime. And the replacement number is 2.1. You think it's about 2.0, but a few children don't make it to adulthood, so it's 2.1. And when that number is crossed, the world's population will stop growing. And that will happen, we think, sometime around 2050 or 2060, that we will hit that number. And the driver for this, it used to be that people thought about this, Malthus and even Paul Ehrlich thought about this as, oh, more resources means your population will expand. But it's the opposite. In every country that is well off and where women have political rights, have freedoms, and have educations, fertility drops because women can have other choices, other things they can do with their lives. And when you look at the few countries where population is still growing rapidly, they're Nigeria, Sudan, Indonesia. And it may surprise you, some of the countries where population, where fertility is below 2.0. Iran, fertility rate 1.6. Brazil, fertility rate 1.7. Countries that you would think would still have a booming population are actually below the fertility rate, below the replacement rate already. And this is profoundly good news. In fact, it may be too good news, maybe pushing us to a different problem of not enough kids being born. It's a very serious thing to worry about. It may be that there's a Goldilocks zone right around here, and you see now countries in Europe and Japan worrying about how do we create incentives for people to have kids. So this is not the problem we once feared it was.
Ramez Nam, a computer scientist and the author of The Infinite Resource, The Power of Ideas on a Finite Planet. He spoke at Town Hall on September 9th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Irritable Bowel Syndrome Treatment Center, specializing in IBS, gluten sensitivity, celiac disease, and related digestive problems. Details on customized IBS solutions at ibstreatmentcenter.com or on Facebook. 10 o'clock, KUOW FM 94.9 Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.